Dazzling, inventive, and precise. Those are words editor Robert Stewart used in his New Letters magazine tribute to describe the language of the late Conger Beasley Jr., who was also his friend and co-publisher at Woodscote Press. An experimental fiction writer, Beasley roamed the world, making his living as a serious travel writer and essayist, with more than 24 books of short stories, novels, poetry, and nonfiction, such as travel guides to wild places. But he always came back to Kansas City and nearby birthplace, St. Joseph, Missouri, where he would have celebrated his 77th birthday on August 21st, 2017, under the skies of a total eclipse. We celebrate this past American voice, beginning with a serious reading from his book that won the 1991 Thorpe Men Award for Literary Achievement, featured in an archive New Letters on the Air with then-host Rebecca Presson.
The book is titled Sundancers and River Demons, Essays on Landscape and Ritual. This is the beginning of the essay referred to in the title, an account of the piercing ritual practiced by the Oglala Sioux Indians of North Dakota.
This piece is entitled Blood for the Sun. We had eaten lunch discreetly out of sight behind our car and had just stepped back under the brush arbor when we saw something that neither of us had ever seen before. Two men, suspended by ropes pinned to the flesh above their shoulder blades, were hanging 6 feet over the ground. Dark blood trickled down their backs. Their long, glossy hair gleamed like a raven's wing. Each man clutched an eagle feather, which he flapped urgently up and down. A hot August sun boiled overhead. Under the shade of the arbor, other men, clad in T-shirts and ball caps, beat drums and wailed in high-pitched voices. A throbbing sound mixed with ululating cries floated out over the tall cottonwood in the center of the circle. From the topmost branches dangled taut ropes with their grisly human cargo. A stiff breeze whirling across the arbor kicked up curlicues of dust. For most of the morning we had watched other types of piercing, mainly involving young men and boys. With pegs protruding from their chests, they had pulled back with all their strength against ropes tied to the cottonwood tree until the pegs popped free. That was absorbing enough, but the two men hanging limply from the branches was a sight we could not comprehend. Though we could acknowledge what was happening, the reason seemed mysterious and arcane. We were confronted by a spectacle that plumbed the very heart of Aboriginal America. An ancient ritual known as the Sundance is performed every summer out on the Great Plains at the Sioux, Cheyenne, and Crow Indian reservations. It is one of the most extraordinary Native American rituals, rivaling anything else on the continent in power and mysticism, including the Hopi Snake Dance and the Yaqui Deer Dance. The one we witnessed took place on the Pine Ridge Reservation of South Dakota, home of the Oglala Sioux. The Oglala have an interesting history. The largest branch, the Teton or Western Sioux, their ancestry, according to anthropologists, goes all the way back to Tennessee and North Carolina. External pressures in the 16th century forced them to embark upon a long migration through the Ohio River Valley to Minnesota, where, in the late 17th century, they first encountered French traders and trappers. Driven from Minnesota by the Chippewa, they ventured out into the northern plains, reaching the Black Hills around 1775. During the long struggle against European encroachment onto their hunting grounds, they were led by such warriors as Red Cloud and Crazy Horse. In battles along the Bozeman Trail between 1866 and 1868, and at the Rosebud and Little Bighorn Rivers, they either defeated federal troops or fought them to a standstill. The 1880s were a grim time for the Oglala. With the buffalo ruthlessly decimated by white hunters, they were forced to live on reservations where rations could be doled out to them. The Sundance was outlawed in 1884, and for good reason. Anyone willing to subject themselves to such an ordeal would most likely find campaigning against the United States cavalry an invigorating sport. And so, like many practices censored by the federal government, the Sundance went underground and for nearly half a century was performed away from disapproving eyes in remote pockets of the Pine Ridge Reservation. In 1934, as a result of the Indian Reorganization Act, which established the legality and white parlance of many religious activities, the Sundance resurfaced, albeit in a bowdlerized version that did not include piercing. In the 1960s, with the advent of the Red Power movement and the corresponding heightening of Indian consciousness, piercing recommenced in earnest. It is an unsettling spectacle for a Wasishu to witness. Our Judeo-Christian tradition sanctions martyrdom, but only when it holds out the promise of salvation. Christ suffered fearsome torments on the cross, but he was finally relieved of his agony by death in the ascension of his body into heaven. But to suffer physical agony for the living, so that one's people may benefit, is not as comprehensible. And yet that is why, today as in the past, Aglala men subject themselves to the rigors of piercing. Participation in the ritual is voluntary. Not every man feels compelled to undertake it. A sign or signal in the form of a dream or vision usually indicates a person's willingness. Others participate to give thanks for having survived a crisis. The intensity of suffering forms a deep bond, not only between the dancers, but with the oldest and most sacred tribal traditions. As Arthur Amiot, a Sioux artist, has said, quote, "Inherent in the sun dance itself is the total epistemology of a people. It tells us of their values, their ideals, their hardships, their sacrifice, their strong and unerring belief in something ancient." The ultimate aim of the ordeal is to bring the participant into contact with Wakantaka, the supreme manifestation of spiritual power in the Sioux cosmology. The circle formed by the brush arbor, of which the tree is the center, is a holy and mysterious place. Throughout the ceremony, the circle is constantly purged of evil influences by shamans bearing trays of burning sage whose smoke drifts sweetly over the parched and trampled dust. The cottonwood with its raw hide thongs dangling to the ground provides the focal point of the ceremony. Sanctified by elaborate prayer and ritual, it forms the Axis Mundi, the tree of life, by which the participants come into contact with the awesome powers of the earth. In effect, the tree functions as a pipe or stem connecting the mortal body to all that is sacred, or wakan, in the world. The ordeal is vitally important to Aglala traditionalists. Above all, it is theirs, uncorrupted by Christian influences. It is the most compelling antidote they can offer to the negative impact that Wasishu culture has had on their own. It offers a viable alternative to alcoholism, immorality, and spiritual lassitude. The ordeal is inimitably Indian, intensely physical and sublimely visionary, a commitment of body and soul to the preservation of the ideals of the people. This type of offering has no equivalent in our culture. It can't be satisfied by signing a fat check or turning over old clothes to a welfare agency or doing volunteer work in a soup kitchen. The offering can be made only in blood suffering. The Indian religion is a hard one, an old man told me afterwards. It has to be. We have faced the threat of extinction for so long that in order to survive we must be as hard as the granite core of the Black Hills. During a sun dance, friends and family often will have little pieces of flesh gouged out of their arms. These offerings are then deposited on a buffalo skull to dry in the sun to help the dancer endure the misery of hanging by a rope attached to his body by sharp skewers jabbed through the skin. Blood for blood, your blood for mine, our blood for the people.
Conger Beasley Jr. reading from his essay Blood for the Sun from his book Sun Dancers and River Demons, Essays on Landscape and Ritual. Conger, you observed this piercing ritual under the auspices of which federal governmental agency?
Well, I was doing interpretive work one summer at Badlands National Park, and I was up at Badlands to write a little history of the Aglala Sioux. And through the head of interpretation at Badlands, I was given appointments with various tribal leaders, and also included in that was permission to go and observe one of these sun dances.
Now, the essays that are in Sun Dancers and River Demons are not the essays that you wrote for the Park Service.
No, absolutely not. No. Those were more cut and dry. Those were more
informational.
Absolutely, informational. I mean, descriptions of trees and bushes and what kind they are with their Latin names and what kind of fruit and berries that they give. And it was sort of like guidebooks that when you go along one of these trails that has pegs and there's a numbered peg and then you look into your little trail brochure and number 13 tells you about a mesquite tree. But these essays grew out of more thoughtful and meditative and deliberate thoughts about the experiences of being out in those landscapes.
Now, the essay that you read, Blood for the Sun, seems to me to be a fairly straightforward account of what you saw, with not a great deal of interpretation. But some of your other essays that are on landscape seem quite arbitrary. You've just chosen whatever you wanted to see and report on. Mm-hmm. What do you look for when you go to a place? What sorts of things strike you and make you think I should write about this aspect of this place?
Well, in the case of the Sundance piece, the experience was so overwhelming. The experience of watching this incredibly powerful ceremony was so overwhelming that the only thing that I wanted to do was just to report as faithfully as I possibly could what I witnessed. In the case of other essays, for example, there's one called River of Thunder, River of Gold, which is an account of a float trip on the San Juan River, which runs through the Four Corners area. And in that, I was very interested in my responses to the landscape, to being on the river, to being caught as I was with my four other companions on the river in a flash flood. Not all of these experiences of being out in the wild are uplifting or ennobling or inspiriting. Some of them are just downright frightening. And there's a certain element of paranoia and terror that is associated with being out in these landscapes, especially someone like myself who comes from a rather urban background, who, though now in my late 40s, originally started doing this about 20 years ago. And I lived in New York City for many years and fancied myself an absolute urban dude. And to take that kind of a metropolitan sensibility and to take it out into petrified forest, for example, out onto the painted desert, out onto that incredible landscape of openness, that eerie, desolate, peeled landscape where there are no familiar identifying features, to have oneself plunked out there with this sort of city sensibility can be a pretty traumatic experience.
Some of the places that you go to are like the last place that anybody would ever think of going to, like the Salt Key Island in the Caribbean, apparently a very desolate place. Mm-hmm. And then on your trip to Alaska, you had a rather unusual experience in that rather than going and looking at scenery, you were hunting for seals to be used for research.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've been going to Santa Barbara to observe the mating habits of whales lately. Do you seek out these kinds of things, or are they just handed to you?
Well, in the case of the Alaskan thing, I was asked to go on a scientific expedition with a group of marine biologists from Moss Landing in Monterey Bay, California. And one of the people on board the boat was a man who was with the Alaskan Department of Fish and Game, and he was undertaking the first scientific collection of harbor seals in the eastern Bering Sea, and he needed help. And I wasn't there for any specific function, and so I attached myself to him and became his helper. But in general, I like remote, desolate, forlorn, far-off places. And sometimes they're much closer to wherever you live than you think. You don't have to go to Afghanistan or to the remote ends of the earth to find them. Salt Key, which is a part of the Turks and Caicos Islands, is one of the most remote and desolate places I've ever found. And yet you can get there in one day, for example, from Kansas City by flying to Miami. But I like places in which not only is there a certain amount of physical space, a certain amount of openness and whatnot, but seem to be relatively untouched by time and by the corrupting influences of civilization.
Something that I notice that seems to happen repeatedly in the essays is that you find something in the places and the people that you encounter that reminds you of your own life or your own early life, almost to the point where I wonder if what you're doing out there isn't finding out that we're all very similar at heart. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's probably so. I have found that landscape, particularly of these forlorn, desolate places, operate as a catalyst upon my imagination and memory. And when I'm there, I'm always reminded of earlier experiences when I was a boy. I grew up in the Midwest in the state of Missouri in a small Missouri River town, and not that anything was so desolate or arid there, but there's something about a small town. There's an openness, and sometimes there's a sense of possibilities, of untapped resources, of being in places where time forgot. The town that I grew up in, St. Joseph, Missouri, was, well, I think historically, the westernmost extension of any significant French culture that was ever settled on the North American continent. A lot of the buildings in downtown St. Joe in the 1940s and early 50s were very reflective of French architectural values. There are a lot of mansard roofs and dormer windows, and I remember the first time I went to France, and I threw open the shutters of my window of my hotel in Paris and gazed out upon this vast sea of mansard roofs and dormer windows, and I thought to myself, it was one of those moments like a shock of recognition. I thought, I've seen all this. But I had only seen it, of course, in a very minuscule way. But St. Joseph was settled by French trappers in the 1820s, the Ribadeau family, and it had a lot of that feeling. And there was something about that town, too, being located on a river. And there's something absolutely, I think, transfixing about rivers, because there's a sense of motion and there's the sense of possibility, the sense of getting on the river and going somewhere different, the whole thing that Mark Twain wrote about so effectively.
The late Conger Beasley Jr. talking in 1990 with Rebecca Presson about his eighth book, Sundancers and River Demons, Essays on Landscape and Ritual. He was only 8 years old when he was first published by the St. Joseph News Press. It was a poem about World War II that began his exploration of various genres over his nearly seven decades of writing. Stay with us for one of his never-before-aired fantastical short stories with some sexual overtones that may raise eyebrows. I'm Angela Elam, and when I began New Letters on the Air in 1996, we talked after his next book won the Western Writers of America's Spur Award for Contemporary Nonfiction. We are a people in this world. The Lakota Sioux and the Massacre at Wounded Knee recounts not just the history of 1890, but also the 100th anniversary and the Bigfoot Memorial Ride organized by the Lakota people, who for the first time allowed outsiders to participate, including Conger Beasley Jr.
About halfway through the ride, it occurred to me that The narrative would have this dual emphasis, that in order to highlight the events of December of 1990, I would have to put it in a proper historical context. And what better way to open or announce that context than with the assassination of Sitting Bull, a very dramatic event, and then to come up to the present and then to boomerang back and forth between the two dates.
I guess we should describe for people the situation. This began in December. It was the coldest weather in decades.
Yes. In a way, this was a good omen for many of the Lakota people because they believe that the real healing, scourging winds come out of the north, and that sometimes in order to properly heal something, you have to go through this period of intense cold, absolutely sub-zero, frigid weather, and it scours everything. It wipes the slate clean, and you can begin again. And so that first day, December the 22nd, when it was 17 below, that actually turned out to be the warmest day of the entire week. And progressively, as we got closer and closer to Wounded Knee, as we closed in upon our objective, our target, the days became much colder until on the afternoon of December the 28th, 1990, when we walked and we rode into Wounded Knee. The temperature, not the wind chill, but the temperature was about 45 degrees below zero.
Well, what you were doing was a very dramatic thing. What brought you to this escapade in the first place?
In the summer of 1982, I did interpretive work at Badlands National Park in South Dakota. And it was there that I knew about the Lakota Sioux, and I knew about Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, and I knew some of the stories and whatnot prior to that. But Badlands National Park is located just north of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and I had been hired for the summer to do a little interpretive brochure about the Oglala Sioux. And I went down onto the reservation on a number of occasions and talked to Indian people. And I was living next door to an Indian family, the Running Hawks, Dominic and Phoebe Running Hawk, who appear in the book and who turned out to be wonderful people and remain close personal friends. I really became fascinated by the culture because these people were very serious, not only about the business of living, but they were very serious about the business of preserving their culture. And the fact that they had managed to do so under the most incredible odds, I mean, when you think of the assimilation process that began to take place among the Lakota people starting in the 1880s, their land was taken away from them, their children were taken away from them, they were forbidden to speak their own language, they were forced to dress in westernized costumes and whatnot. Instead of living in these circular teepees, they were forced to live in these square, boxy houses. It's a miracle that their culture has survived. Not only has it survived, but it is growing now. It is flourishing. I really think it's one of the miracles that has taken place on this continent.
I want to talk about the kinds of writing that you do, because you do a lot of different things. This has a historical perspective to it. And in a way, it's a travel story, and you do a lot of travel stories in the Kansas City Star and
various magazines, Eco Traveler magazines. I do travel pieces, and I also have done environmental investigative journalistic pieces as well.
And you have a book of essays with Bookmark Press.
The volume is called Eyes Open in the Dark, and it consists of 8 essays ranging from places that I've been to in the last 10 years, from the Leaning Tower of Pisa to southeastern Arkansas, where I went and watched some Arkansas men in November of 1981 go on a deer hunt, which is something near and dear to their hearts.
Now, I know, too, that you write short stories, and I have here The Blood of Dead Poets, some of your stories that were published by Wordcraft of Oregon, and this was book number 12 in the Wordcraft Speculative Writer Series. It's really a nice book because it has some sketches in it done by the artist Richard Schindler.
Yes, and these are 14 fantastical stories. About 10 years ago, I published an earlier volume called My Manhattan. Woods Cole Press did that here in Kansas City. And my fiction is very much different from my nonfiction.
Very much. It's very strange. I mean, I just wasn't expecting what came out because they're very otherworldly. I was wondering if you could read us the shortest story in here, Woman with a Hole in the Center of Her Chest.
Sure.
And this will kind of give people a taste of what you do.
How it got there, she's not sure. One morning she awoke with a hole in the center of her chest the size of a 50-cent piece. When her husband tried to inspect it, she drew away. "This isn't yours," she announced. "You have no business here. Leave it alone, and don't try and stick anything in it while I'm sleeping. I'm not kidding. She protected the hole with the ferocity of a lion. It was centered between her breasts. When she took off her bra, she could see in the bathroom mirror her heart pump blood. The action was like an old-fashioned butter churner, up and down with a rhythmic slushing. Occasionally a droplet spilled out and ran down her stomach. Her husband peered over her shoulder in alarm. "You better see a doctor," he whispered. "I'm fine," she said. "I never felt better in my life." The visits to her gynecologist, which she used to dread, no longer bothered her. Her husband's nocturnal urges, which she could barely tolerate, she no longer resisted. While he churned inside her, even as the gynecologist probed with scientific detachment, she kept thinking to herself, "It doesn't matter. Let them take what they want. I'm a tree whose bark conceals a secret. This opening leads to my heart. Those other openings lead to other places." One night, an animal crawled into the hole and made a nest. The animal was small, with sleek fur, pointed nose, and marble-white eyes like fish that live in subterranean caves. The woman could feel it crawl across her belly to the opening. She wasn't afraid. When it slipped inside, she rolled on her stomach so it couldn't escape. Next morning, after her husband left for work, she went into the bathroom and took off her robe and slipped the straps of her nightgown off her shoulders. A blue jay, perched on a limb outside the window, gazed at her breasts. "Whoever you are," she whispered, "come out and let me see you." But the animal wouldn't budge. Despite the heat, despite the slush of blood, it had found a place where it felt protected. Blood drenched its soft hairs. There was plenty to drink. "Come out. Come out and let me see you." The blue jay hopped to the window and tapped the glass. The animal heard the tapping and squirmed out of sight behind a cataract of blood. The woman moaned. While the blue jay watched, she inserted a finger deep inside herself. She threw back her head and opened her mouth. Her face was ecstatic. Her eyes radiated a brilliant green light. The blue jay screeched and flapped its wings. The woman braced her feet against the floor. The animal inside her chest bit the tip of the probing finger with its sharp, white teeth.
A peek into the imagination of Conger Beasley Jr. with the story Woman with a Hole in the Center of Her Chest from The Blood of Dead Poets. A risque historical story from the 1996 collection is ahead about a presidential romp, so cover any sensitive ears. But first, here's some insight into his experimental fiction.
I'm not sure what that story is about. I really cannot adequately account for the origin of it. About 25 years ago when I started writing fiction, actually 30 years ago, the first novel that I wrote was a very straightforward kind of novel. But the protagonist of this novel was a young college professor who wanted to be a writer. And during the course of this novel, he sits down and writes a story which is extremely fantastic. Now, the novel in which he appears is very straightforward and linear. But the excerpt which I wrote and which was included in this novel was very fantastic and surreal. And so my second novel, I decided to cut to the chase, in effect, and I realized that something was going on in my psyche, in my subconscious, in my personality, whatever it is. Something was going on that I wanted, images, notions, ideas, dreamlike visions and whatnot, that I wanted to get to right away. So when I wrote my second novel, which was a fantasy story about a man living at the bottom of a swimming pool in Palm Springs and slowly turning into a fish, I realized that I had arrived where I needed to be as a novelist. And I decided to let In terms of fiction, in terms of doing stories, I wanted to base them on the most intimate subconscious things that I could possibly come to grips with. So I decided not to be afraid of anything that came to my consciousness during this whole period, and to simply see if I couldn't take some of these materials, which were strange, which were bizarre, which were personally frightening, and to see if I couldn't weave them into a coherent narrative. And that has been kind of the fictional ethos by which I have written stories and novels ever since.
Now, you use some real people as the basis of your stories. You've got a short piece with Stravinsky, the composer, as a main character. What about Nan and Warren? Was Warren Harding, did he really have
absolutely
this relationship?
Absolutely based on historical fact, including their trysting sessions in the cloakroom downstairs on the first floor of the White House. Now, I consulted several biographies about that. Now, I added just a few details, and you might say that I entered their minds, and that's the most fictionalized part of it. But that actual relationship, that affair, did in fact take place.
Well, why don't you read it for us?
I'd be delighted to. I'm very fond of this story. Nan and Warren, 1921. Nan and Warren were lovers. She was a lowly seamstress. He was president of the United States. They consummated their passion regularly on the floor of a downstairs cloakroom in the White House. A Secret Service agent brought Nan in the back door while Mrs. Harding, the dragon, as Warren affably called her, was upstairs supervising the domestic help. Warren told his secretary he had an appointment in another part of the house and slipped out of the Oval Office. Late morning was the optimum time for their tryst before Warren had lunch. Warren ate big lunches, washed down with many bottles of beer. Afterward, slumped in a comfortable chair, feet propped up on an ottoman, he sank into a heavy slumber. The cloakroom was a large walk-in space crowded with garments. Warren flung topcoats and jackets on the floor to make a pallet. There in the dark, with only a sliver of light leaking under the door, he fumbled for Nan, calling her name, fondling her breasts. The cloakroom was no place for a leisurely bout of coy arousal. Nan, who'd already removed her hat and unbuttoned her dress, lurched toward him. Pawing blindly, they clunked like railroad cars on a lonely siding in the late-night dark of a Midwestern town. The first kiss was electric. They tugged at their clothes, clawing at buttons, hooks, stays. Warren, a gouty man, peeled off his coat, vest, and trousers. Nan pulled up her dress, loosened her corset, settled back against the cushion of coats. Warren's heart gibbered like a baboon. Pivoting on one knee, he settled his bulky hips between Nan's thighs. Swiftly, deftly, she guided the presidential member inside her. An Ohio hoyden with a knack for gratifying big-time politicians, she received his awkward thrust with an endearing grunt. Warren began to wheeze like a locomotive up the slopes of the Sierras. Together they rasped out little avowals of affection, trying not to titillate the ears of the Secret Service agent standing guard on the other side of the door, yet longing to make some kind of confession, a verbal affirmation to the spastic hunch of their bodies. Nan and Warren, the ultimate illicit conjunction at the nexus of American power, with telephones ringing, secretaries typing, decisions pending, important politicos waiting for an audience, hot, raunchy, subversive. Isn't that fantastic? Don't you just love it? Isn't that better than Dick Nixon and his cronies smearing the walls with vituperation and hate, or Ron and Nancy counting ball gowns and watching old movies, Nan and Warren humping like gerbils in the cloister of their little cage? Good for them. They must really have wanted one another. All the scheming they had to do, all the risks they took, all the clothes they had to remove. I hope they had a good time. I hope they had deep, satisfying orgasms. I hope, when they parted, their cheeks glowed with good health and their hearts boomed like bass drums in a Beethoven symphony.
Nan and Warren, from The Blood of Dead Poets, published in 1996 as part of WordCraft's Speculative Writers series. Though the late Conger Beasley Jr. was known for his award-winning nonfiction and travel writing, his last book in 2015 was a fantastical novel called A Little Story About Maurice Ravel, published by the Journal of Experimental Fiction. The author, who died in August 2016, would have turned 77 on August 21st, 2017, under the skies of the total eclipse in his hometown of St. Joseph, Missouri. For more, visit newletters.org for links to his essay collection from Bookmark Press called Eyes Open in the Dark, and to the New Letters magazine special tribute to Conger Beasley in the Jazz Issue, Volume 83.1. Today's show was assembled from three different programs and some previously unaired materials, with help from Scott Middleton at Marsound Archives and our own Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.